Hello everyone, welcome back to People's Internet Radio. I'm Jill Trebilcock, and it's always such a privilege to come in on the back of Vin's show. I feel terrified, actually. I think I should feel terrified even if I don't feel particularly terrified, but I feel humbled anyway, to come in after Vin, who just knows so many sovereign solutions. I've brought in some Australian solutions to sanity. One of my favourite people to entertain me and a lot of you, Sue Ingleton, who is an Australian actress who sometimes brings along her friend, or always brings her friend Edith Wise, who sometimes I wonder about her wisdom, but anyway, she's fantastic. And Sue won the...
Just hang on a minute. I'm terribly sorry, Jill, and all those lovely people out there in Midnight Land. This is Edith Wise. She's put you on hold. No, she's put herself on hold. But I'm going to tell them the truth, all right? She's got irritable bowel syndrome. Now, if I have to deal with this one more time in a public speaking place like internet radio, I'm very, very sorry. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. I'm just going to fill them in.
You tell them.
My name is Edith Wise, and I'm very, very old. I'm a nonagenarian, which means I don't eat anything. It's much cheaper. you're old, you know. Everything either dries up or it leaks. I'll tell you. I'm sorry, that's my colostomy bag backing up. I don't have to bother about going to the toilet like Sue does. She's in there with... She has a congenital nasal drip too, Jill, which is she's inherited both these things from her mother, I believe. I'm not related to this person at all. So I have a friend called Gwen March, and now she's been put into a home. I'm just going to chat here to the people out there at 12 o'clock midnight. People, where are these people, Jill? Where are they listening at? Hello?
They're in Ireland. Edith, have you ever been to Ireland?
Yes, I've been to Ireland. In fact, my friend Gwen Martin, she's got an Irish grandmother back there in the old days. She's been put into a home, and I've got to tell you about this. Is a little story that I go down and visit her, take her some Tina pants and all that sort of business that you need. It's called Golden Days. Now, some idiot has graffitied underneath Golden Days, Nightmare Nights. Can you imagine those poor people in absolute... We don't call them homes. We call them holding paddocks out here in Australia. They're the most dreadful places to end up in. Anyhow, so just let me tell you, I was down there the other day and I was waiting for her to have a business done, you know. And you see, the thing about old age homes is when they're men and women, you know, they desegregate. They keep them well apart. The men don't want to know the women and the women don't want to know the men. Well, you can understand why the women have had enough of men once they get into that place. They've sort of got a bit of peace and quiet. Anyway, so... The men, there were three chaps right up in the sunny room. Now, they get up there early, you know, they chat away. Now, when you're in an old age home situation, all you do is talk about the weather or your bowels. That's all that's left, what's outside the window and what's inside the body, you know. So I was like a fly on the wall, Jill, and there's these three chaps there, and they're fairly elderly, you know, and they're talking, of course, about their bowels. Now, just the first chap, he's about 70. He was, he wasn't that bad looking, actually, but he says... He says, I have a terrible time. He says, I wake up at 7 o'clock every morning and it takes me half an hour to take a pee, you know. As they say in Australia, strain the potatoes, he actually said, but I'll just make it simpler for those midnight people over there on the other side of the planet. And then second chap there, he's about, supposed to have 80, you know. He says, that's nothing. I wake up at 8 o'clock every morning. I sit on that bog for an hour before I can move my bowels. And this other chap, he must be past 90. He perks up and he says, well, I take a pee at 7 and I move my bowels at 8. And they say, well, what's wrong with that, Jack? And he said, well, I don't wake up till 9. it's frightful. It's hell getting old, I'll tell you that now. You know, when I was a young girl, the Dead Sea was only 6. That's how old I am. So, she's still in there. My grandson's, you know, I had a talk with this chap. This woman was outside. Now, she didn't look well. She looked she was a bit past it, although maybe she'd just had sex. I don't know. It has a strange effect on you when you get a bit older. But I used to be highly sexed as a woman, you know, so they tell me I used to blush going in.
I would never have missed that, Edith. I often wonder about this, you know, like...
Well, I know last week, I know that that dildo came into my hands by sheer accident, I have to tell you. It was in an op shop. Now, I actually thought I was buying a baking implement. The straps and the belt got me confused, but I worked it out in the end, as I told you, and I told that extremely strange chap who was rowing a boat up the river or something from some...
Yes, but I tell you, the closest
I get to sex nowadays, honestly, Jill, is when my hot water bottle leaks on me. And I'll tell you this, it wasn't much different when Gordon was alive. Hang on a minute, Jill. You're coming up. I'm coming. All right, leave me alone. It's irritable. Hello, darling. Sorry about that.
Hello, Sue. How are you?
Hello. Just go make a cup of tea. All right. She's up there in the. She's still got the dildo. You wouldn't believe it. She's doing weird things with it. She baked cake with it the other day. Well, it has this vibratory thing, and she was creaming butter and sugar with it. Don't ask me. I didn't eat it.
Oh, Sue, I'm fine. I've been a bit...
That's strange from you on the chat thing, saying that I have to tell jokes, nice jokes about men. I find men are the greatest source of humour on the planet today, but it just depends where you want to go with that.
Although we could go with that last week, because Tim was annoying you so much, and I ended up saying something absolutely insane that I'll never live down again about what...
What did you say?
I said I could understand why men raped men when they wanted to dominate them or something. So I think Edith got the better of me.
Look, there are some beautiful men out there, and including among that group, many of my friends and many of my grandchildren and my son. But overall, it's back in there. The ball is back in their court. The balls are in their court. Well and truly, they've got to come up to the mark now. They've got to help us. They've got to help us. You know, it's really
Yes. Well, we do all have to help each other. And I know that you do have. I don't want to go in this direction.
No. We're going to talk about Edinburgh. What were we going to
talk about?
Let's talk about Ireland. I am an Irish citizen. I have dual citizenship with Ireland because my grandmother was Irish. So I cobbled onto that really quickly, and now I have an Irish passport. And I'm a wee citizen of Ireland, you know. And I think she's come from Donegal, so that's sort of up in the north, but it's Ireland. So that's where I've been twice. Now the first time I went to Ireland, this will kill you. Mm-hmm. I got married to my first husband, there's been so many since, no, there's been none after that. One husband was enough. Had a few de factos and other children, but, you know, marriage was something that was a bit, didn't quite work for me. With the wrong man, nice man, but, you know, that didn't work. We won't go into that, we're not going to talk any more about sex. So I went, got married in England, my mum came over to the wedding, and then my mother and I went on my honeymoon. Together. Now that's
your mother and you went on your honeymoon together.
Probably was not a good precursor for the marriage succeeding, in which it didn't. So then we drove.
How did
to
your
Scotland.
Mother get on the? Wait a minute.
He just got a job, so marriage isn't such a big deal in England. Although let me tell you, we got married in Knightsbridge Cathedral, and this is such a great story. We got married at Knightsbridge Cathedral. Okay, so we booked ourselves in for an afternoon wedding because there was a wedding there in the morning. And there I am living in Pimlico Road somewhere in poverty in England. And I got a phone call one morning from Lady Smythe Hobson Boobs Shit Bum Poo, whatever her name was. She says, hello. She says, I have the wedding at Knightsbridge Cathedral in the morning. And I was wondering if you would like to share the cost of the flowers.
Oh, how hilarious.
I said in a very good Australian accent, oh, look, I'm terribly poor and we're only getting married there in the afternoon, so we actually don't have any money for flowers or even the church. Oh, she said, oh, well, I'll just leave them there for you. I said, oh, thanks a lot.
How freshly kind.
Wait,
generous.
got to the church that we walked in. Knightsbridge Cathedral is huge. It's the biggest. I didn't know. I just went into the first church I walked past. So Knightsbridge Cathedral was decorated in yellow and white flowers. Every pew, of which there were like 200 pews, had bunches and posies of flowers. We used up 1.5 pews with our friends in London. And flowers everywhere. Flowers everywhere. And when we went inside, listen, wait for it. We went inside the registry. And the name above the witness for my wedding is the Queen Mother. Hello.
Hello.
So then I went off on the honeymoon with my mum and we drove up to, and my mother isn't the most appalling driver at any time, and even worse at this time. She had never driven a car with gears for many, many years. So I said, oh, look, we'll share the driving. Oh, fool me. Anyway, so the first roundabout, which we don't have in Australia at this point of time, the first roundabout we came to, she drove straight over the middle. It's such a mess. She couldn't steer and change gears at the same time. So that was the last one. So I did all the driving. I love driving. I'm a very good driver, and I've driven around the world many times. Anyway, so then I wanted to go to Ireland. Now, this is the year 1968. Ireland was poverty-stricken. I mean, it was just appalling. We arrived one night, and I can't remember where you docked in Ireland, but we left from England and sailed on the boat to Ireland in this crappy little car that I'd hired. We spent the night in a hotel. We got up in the morning with flea bites all over our bodies. We complained to the people, but then we left. We drove from Dublin. We drove up and around and across and back, and we got on the ferry boat that night and left. That was Ireland, my first trip to Ireland, can you imagine? It was so appalling, and my mother just kept saying she didn't want to be there, and I didn't want to be with my mother anymore. And so I drove around Ireland in a day and left that night. We didn't want another flea night and got back to England. So the second time I went to Ireland was the International Women's Playwrights Conference, because I'm a playwright, and that was in 1997, I think. And then, what was it, 2000? I can't remember. Anyway. And that was when I went on a pilgrimage to find the stories of Ireland. But listen, I had read this most amazing book called Mythic Ireland by a man called Michael Dames. He's the most extraordinary writer, and a man who embraces the goddess history and everything, which has been wiped out in Ireland. It's absolutely incredible. So I actually graffitied a tour bus in Ireland at the New Grange tour bus. It's all right. I did it in the dust of the bus, and I just wrote back, "The goddess is dead here," or something. I can't remember what I wrote.
Oh, that's
right. Right in front of everybody. They all looked at me with their mouths hanging open. I didn't care in the end. I was in tears a lot of the time. It's my ancestral home, you know. It's the most amazing, beautiful, painful. You know, there's this thing, we should talk to, you know, people about this, that the traveling through Europe, for an Australian, if you're born in Australia, you go overseas and you travel through Europe, or you go to Ireland or England or France, wherever, there's not one place where you walk there's not a place where not another foot has ever trodden. You're always walking on the bones and the blood of history, you know. And there's so much pain in the earth of the Northern Hemisphere countries. I feel it because I work with energy all the time, you know. And there's so much amazing spirituality too, the ley lines in Britain and all those amazing places. But you come to Australia and you walk in the desert in Australia, I swear to you, your foot might be the first foot that has ever walked on that piece of earth, you know.
Yes,
and there's the energy here is so much lighter than it is in the Northern Hemisphere countries, you know, because we just don't have that history of blood. We've got our own little history of blood, but it's only around 200 years old. You know, it's as old as we are when the Europeans smashed into this country, you know. Mm. But we don't have, it's just not here. And so you sit and you stare at these huge skies and deserts, and it's just extraordinary to compare what it's like to stand in both those parts of the planet, you know, which is why, you know, that harmonic convergence in 88. Reawakened all the energies, the inner energies of the planet, all the southern hemisphere energies from Machu Picchu, Uluru, to the other one, South America. Which one is it? Africa. Yeah, the mountain in Africa. Help me. I can't remember the name of it.
I can't help you. I do know a lot of people who are involved in the energies of the earth. Kilimanjaro.
And Machu Picchu, they all linked up in the harmonic convergence, which led us up to 2012, and now we are in a planetary realignment. And if it doesn't happen soon, I'm going to have to kill Tony Abbott myself, I suppose. Oh,
yeah, well, he definitely needs a planetary alignment.
With a stun gun.
And he's got to stop.
I'd love to have a stun gun too. Yeah, she wants a stun gun, but anyway, we'll work on taser gun. It's a taser gun, Edith. A taser gun! Yeah, there you go. So, you talk now. Come on.
Oh, well, I don't really know what to say, but I did go, but I do understand why people like to go to the desert, and I have been to the desert, and a lot, people are very romantic about going to the desert. And it is so spacious, and I was lucky enough to go to Uluru, which, for people who don't know, is what was called Ayers Rock, when I was 14. And, it was very magical, and I went into one of the fertility caves there, which are now you can't go into them anymore because, you know, the Aboriginals or Indigenous Australians, or they like to call themselves, I've been told this by someone who lives at Alice Springs, they would prefer to be called original land, your original carers of the land, and that's from the woman who's in charge of that area. Up there around Uluru, Ezra.
And Uluru is a masculine energy site, and Katajuta is the feminine energy site. Katajuta means many heads, and that was called the Olgas.
Yes, I've been there, and that is the spiritual energy there is incredible.
It is amazing, and I went there, I think I was there in 92, and I did a show up there, and I went out. You call yourself going out, which means you go out into the desert. With a couple of women, and we had this most amazing time. It was a full moon, and we camped. You're not meant to stay the night in there, but the woman.
Oh, I stayed the night there. Back in the old days. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, anyway, well, this was 92. Yeah. I know that all.
Yeah, well, I was in about 70 something.
Oh, yeah. Well, now they have the rangers going around. But however, our costume designer who came to the show, the three women went out. We went out. And her brother is the was the head ranger, and he sort of took us aside. He said the rangers do their last run at 9 o'clock at night. He sort of gave us the big wink. So we snuck in after that, and we camped, and we saw the full moon rise over Katajuta. And the next day, I went off on my own up the Valley of the Winds and did a life death arrow ceremony for myself, which was pretty stunning. A life death arrow ceremony is when you make a life arrow and you make a death arrow and you burn the death arrow. So I actually lit a fire in the Olgas, which was in the Katajuta, which was illegal. But
it's a very yang thing. Go on.
I managed to, the planes fly over all the time now. These little Cessnas go over and taking tourists on flights over Uluru and over Katajuta, you know, so you don't actually have to get dirty. And so I was ducking the planes and hiding the smoke, and I had an eagle come and crow came and talked to me the whole way through the ceremony, and you know, amazing stuff, just fantastic stuff.
That's real stuff. Is real stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very special stuff, and you know, you can, when you work in shamanic tradition, you can go to places like that, and you really have to do very little. You know, the Sacred Gorge is another amazing place for people who ever come to Australia. You know, these places, this in the Flinders Ranges. In South Australia, it's called the Sacred Gorge. It's a women's birthing centre, which I understood after I'd gone backwards up the birth canal, and I thought something's really wrong here. And then I realised that I was walking up the birth canal instead of coming down the other way into the birthing energy. So, but the sad part was, you know, Jill, this amazing sacred gorge, it's called. There were no Aboriginal women there. There was a sign. There was no, you know, I kept thinking if this was in another part of the world, those guardians of that site would be there in some form or another, you know, keeping watch, living there somehow. I don't know. It was weird. It was a bit weird. Mm.
What was weird?
Well, there were no Aboriginal people there looking after it. There were no women there to start with who could have been guiding people. And yeah. We camped down there, and when I understood what was going on there, because it was my second visit there, and I finally understood the energies and everything, and I said to a couple of people, don't walk up that gorge. Go over the mountain on the left and come down the gorge. Don't go up it. You're doing reverse energy, you know?
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Oh,
it is an extraordinary place. And this it was like I was, as I said, I was 14, and I think I rode a camel in there, and it was just like, oh, it was an extraordinarily spacious and spiritual experience, and you could just feel the people and see the people. And I didn't actually see anybody physically, though I have seen Aboriginal spirits physically since. Well, I can tell you about that. This beautiful property we had up in Kinkin, inland from Noosa.
In the
hinterlands of the Sunshine Coast. The Sunshine Coast bordering on the next one. There was a lot of very, very powerful Aboriginals lived there, and the ones who lived on our land were called pygmies, pygmy Aboriginals, right? They were
really?
Pygmy Aboriginals, yes. And I was lucky enough to meet this fellow called Brett Green, whose great-great-grandfather is an anthropologist who actually documented a lot about what happened around the 1850s around Noosa, Tincan Bay, Gympie, and around there. And so you wouldn't believe what was going on there.
Well, I don't think it would be very pleasant, would it?
Well, it was disgusting. Some of the creeks, our property was called Sister Tree. It was the head of the Sister Tree Creek. Well, I named it Sister Tree. When we bought it, it was called Lone Pine. And I thought,
my grandfather General Custer stuck up on the top of it.
Exactly. My grandfather was shot in Lone Pine. He just had the tip of his finger shot. In Gallipoli. He said
we
he was the
Native Americans and all those people out there in Midnight Land. That Australia has based its basic tenet for existence is based on the worst military failure in our history, which was at Gallipoli. But apparently, men had a lot of mates there, even though they were slaughtered on the beach. That was the thing that could have happened to them. So yeah, we've just had all these celebrations for that, and I'm sorry. As I wrote in on Facebook, you know, if there had never been another war after World War I, then I could honour Anzac Day. But I tell you what, I can't.
Exactly. Mm. Anyway, so we had these pygmies living on our land. And oddly enough, Sue.
Well, they wouldn't have made much mess, would they? She had pygmies on her land, Sue. Would have just been tiny little plops of poo, little tiny campfires, and little tiny baby dead things. Is that how it worked?
And giant taipans. We had a taipan so big that it actually ended up killing my bull mastiff. And one day, my bull mastiff flushed this this massive taipan, and we just ploughed the paddock. It happened to be in this place we were putting in some lemongrass and some other, what did I put? Siberian watermelons. I grew Siberian watermelons. Everybody get Siberian watermelons. They're incredible. They have orange flesh and they're really sweet and they have a really short growing season. And I bought them
from. They attract taipans.
Oh, God, this is the problem. I couldn't harvest them in the end because I went in to adjust the watering system and put my hand right on top of one. I couldn't believe it. I was so lucky I wasn't bitten. But anyway, Maple, my bull mastiff, she flustered this taipan and it covered three plough areas, which were 6 feet wide each, and it was curling. And so I figured it must have been about 14 feet long. It was massive. It was massive. And you should hear them. When we had our property was actually owned by the governor's botanist before us. And you should have heard it go crashing into the rainforest. And I actually spoke to a local fellow and I said, I think it was a tie. When I first saw it, it was running side by side with my dog. They were both flying. I thought, what a big python. And then I went, no, it's not a python. It's a bloody taipan. I couldn't believe the size of it. And I spoke to, some of the local guys and I was telling them about it. And this guy said, did it make a lot of noise when it went into the rainforest? And I said, it made a hell of a noise. And they said, that's a taipan. They just crash through everywhere. They're really, really tough snakes. They're really tough.
I lived on the north coast of New South Wales for 18 years and we had to deal with death adders. And that's That is one of the most, I think snakes are quite beautiful and amazing, but the death adder to me was the most evil looking creature. It had it had that arrow head, you know, that triangle head and eyes, and it rippled. It was like a feral sweater rippling along the ground. That was the pattern, exquisite pattern. But I tell you what, absolutely loaded with death, that one, the death adder. I had to shoot two. I had to shoot. It was horrible. I don't want to talk about that. And we lost dogs to snakes, yeah. King Browns were the dynamite ones. They were incredible.
But, you know, I've learned you can put because one day I was sitting on the back veranda and this taipan went straight over my foot. And I'm just going past.
Thought you were a Siberian melon.
That's when I turned into a Siberian melon, actually.
It said, look, there's two Siberian melons here. Let's take a dive. it's impossible. Just drink your tea. I should get up and make her a cup of tea. That'll shut her up. Anyway. We have to write books. We have to share this. It's such a funny thing. I mean, I know Americans, any of them out there, have you got a chat room? Because I can't see anything here.
We've got a chat room.
But, you know,
we should put some batteries in the taipan and turn it. Go on.
We've got the best array of snakes and spiders and horrible things here.
God, sure have.
Just terrible.
If you put the garden hose on them, that's the way you can handle them without killing them. You just squirt them like this. Taipan decided to just sort of take them. Edith would be helpful at that. Squirt a colostomy bag at them.
She can't even handle a trouser snake, darling. I think she won't handle anything bigger. Why are women so bad at maths? Because for thousands of years, men have been telling them that this is 9 inches. Spreading her fingers on internet radio to about 4. Oh, dear, dear. I tell you what, I couldn't go through life with one of them hanging off the front of me. I couldn't stand it.
Oh, the scariest part is the testicles. I would hate to be kicked in the testicles. Oh,
There's a thought, you know, all these movies, and I was watching some other movie where men are punching the shit out of themselves, you know, all I got to do is kick the guy in the balls and he's down, but none of them. It's the unspoken law of men fights, you know. Nothing to blow the bell. But if a woman's fighting a man, it's the first thing she does. They don't want us to know how deadly it can be. So, yes. Just any ladies out there in Midnight Land? Are there any?
Oh, yes, there is. Yes, they're cracking some of the best jokes.
All right, well, you just teach your daughters, girls. That's the best way. Well, teach your sons as well. God knows they need to be protected as well for boys. Oh. So Edinburgh. We did did we get to Edinburgh?
I did want to go to Edinburgh. You tell us.
Oh, okay. So I went to I did a show here called Stripjack Naked, which was all these different characters. Again, another one-woman show. It's very political, my theatre. Yes. And very funny.
Stripjack Naked. You're hilarious. It's just so funny. You're gone.
The last character in it was a woman called Aubergine, and she was dressed entirely in black. And she because they don't know that word. All right, eggplant.
probably aubergine. Go on.
Completely dressed in black, and she came out, and she was a separatist lesbian feminist filmmaker, and she spoke really deadly language, and she was very Australian and very.
Esther said, "Get a rattlesnake, Jill. No need for the batteries." Do go on.
Anyway, so she ended up telling people how she refused to film women anymore because she didn't want men to perv on them, so she just filmed the script. She filmed the script because she refused to exploit women on the screen. Oh, God. Anyway, so that was a show that had some fantastic characters. There was a fantastic, you know, even then, back in 1984, 85, when I did the show here, and I did it in Edinburgh in 85, and then I did it at Montreal. It was just Perrier in Montreal for 1986. I did it there for the Juste Perrier Festival. But, you know, there was Gemma, who is this wonderful character who I still do, who's very, she's has had so many drugs. She She's got, I've got three children. See, four children. I've got two children by my ex-husband, one by my ex-lover, and the last one I had by myself. And she's completely off the planet, but also very political, but
let's
in a
self-abusive
way. Oh, look, it's too early in the morning to drag Jim around. there were these characters, and there was quite a few of them, and I did a show. Someone said it was like Pina Bausch. So at the time in 85, I didn't know who Pina Bausch was, but I had this amazing dress made, this white strapless evening gown with a, mm-hmm. with a frame underneath it that the gown could stand on the floor on its own without a body.
Oh,
in
wow.
It.
Wow.
And so in this white gown, and I played the Otis Redding song, She May Be Weary, Women Do Get Weary, Wearing That Same Shabby Dress. So out comes this woman in this dress to sing. I never left the stage. I changed on stage the whole thing. And so she has this white dress on, and she's got a cup of tea. She has a teacup and a saucer, and she's offering it to her guy, you know. And when he says, when that song goes very, it goes, try a little tenderness, and he goes right off in it. The guy hits her, and the teacup flies out of her hand and smashes on the floor, and he hits her, and he hits her, and he hits her. And she gradually gets worked to the back of the stage with this song pummeling her. And I got out of the dress and stepped out of it and left the dress there with him, and she disappears. Which is, the audience just says, love it, you know. So, and then there was this flyaway panel of white net that hung over the back of the dress. And as I left, I tucked that away, and on the back of the dress was this big blood stain, like a menstrual blood stain. And when Aubergine came out at the end, she comes out and she says, look at that fucking dress, you know, this is like the dress is modest pet. You know those modest pet ads, you know, where the women are in a giant frock, you know, just so they don't hide the modest pet. And then she turns it around, she says, ah, fuck it is. It's around, and there was this big blood stain on it. Well, of course,
this in Edinburgh.
Yeah, I did it in Montreal and Edinburgh and Australia and places, yeah, or whatever. Interesting. So I was nominated for the Perry Award that year, and we were on at the Assembly Rooms, and straight after us was straight before us was this little known theatre company, who were doing a show called More Bigger Snacks Now, where the young men would be throwing food all around the room, and hysterically funny show, absolutely wonderful. And they had two shows there, A Minute Too Late, which was all about death, wonderful, wonderful show, and this show. And this little known theatre company won the Perry Award that year, and the name of the theatre company was the Theatre de Complicité. And that was when I met Simon, and, you know, we just had he invited us up to his house in his aunt's estate in Scotland, and we all drove up there and caught trout in the private trout ponds in the morning and had trout for breakfast and stayed in this divine little cottage on the hill, and we could look out over the valley, and the wild reindeer would all come down in the morning, the dusting of snow, and it was the best. It was the most amazing time. It was incredible. It was really wonderful. So I didn't win, but I got nominated, and they didn't quite know what to do with me because it was the first one-woman show that they'd ever seen, I think. So,
That's amazing. Did you know that I can do Tibetan tantric voice? The people in chat are saying what you do if you don't. Oh, no. They want to know how I growl, you know, sort of go. I go.
It sounds like Edith in the morning.
Why can't you deep enough? I could go deep, guys. Don't you worry. You want to know deep throat? I've got it.
Oh, what fantasy is that? That a man can stick his in the woman's mouth and give her an orgasm. How many men who are the bad ones, who you know,
the bad ones,
the nutters who are having a making women perform sexual acts on them, don't they ever think that the woman's going to bite him off? I mean, wouldn't that be if that happened to me, I'd just sink my teeth in. Sorry.
You're hilariously cruel.
I was doing something the other day about Margaret Thatcher. I know. I have this character up here for the CWA, which is Country Women's Association, called Violet Stride. So she's actually related to Margaret Thatcher. No, she doesn't. There's this fantastic Margaret Thatcher joke where Margaret Thatcher's having lunch at the parliamentarian, in the parliament, you know, the English parliament dining room. And she's in there with all her ministers. And so the waiter comes up to take her order. And she says, I'll have the roast beef. And he says, yes, ma'am. And the vegetables. And she looks at all the ministers. She says, they'll have what I'm having. Did you get that? Shall I tell it again for the slow people?
Yeah, tell it again.
What do you have, ma'am? She says, oh, I'll have the roast beef. And the vegetables, ma'am? Oh, they'll have what I'm having. And it was a bit like that. Almost, God, she was an amazing. She was amazing. She was horrible, but she was, boy, was she ever amazing. I'm just reading a wonderful book by David White, who I did some work with once in Kripalu, up in North State, up in Upper State New York area there, up there, the Adirondacks or whatever's up there. And it's called Crossing the Unknown Sea, Work as a Pilgrimage of Identity. It sounds absolutely dry and awful, but he's the most beautiful poet.
That's
and he just writes beautifully. Yeah,
Work
and
as a Pilgrimage of Identity. Oh, that is... That's...
Work as a Pilgrimage of Identity. And he is writing, and I've just ordered it. I found it at a garage sale. We have garage sales here. I don't know whether people know what that is over there, but everyone gets all their junk out in boxes and puts it in their driveway and sells it for nothing. So I actually got this book for nothing. And I picked it up because I know the man. He's the most beautiful poet. And there you have it. It's a hardback cover too. It's an original edition. I'm going to hang on to it forever. Which won't be very long as far as I'm concerned, Sue. You won't be around. I'll be around longer than you. Yeah, all right.
Does Edith have any teeth? They want to know in chat box.
David White, he's a most handsome, erudite man. W-H-Y-T-E is how he spells his name, and you can Google him and go find his work. It's just, he's wonderful. Here you are. Let me say, here you are. Look, I've been putting stickies in it because there's things I want to come back to. Let me just read you this, what he says about, he has this most amazing relationship with his mother. He says, mother, in italics, mother is probably one of the more incontrovertible truths of life, not amenable to masculine theory. As men, we have no immediate notion of creating another being from our own bodies, of having that part of you grow and go out into the world while still remaining forever you, or that you could trace that reality even in absence, like a lost limb while the body still feels it at present. It's because what happened was his mother had a dream, and literally she reached across halfway across the world to the Galapagos Islands, and she saved his life in a dream. And he found out 3 years after because he never told anyone. In front of my own mother, birthed again into a larger world, looking out from my dad's armchair in the house in which I grew to maturity, the true armchair adventurer. But, you know, it's a journey in his life. And the thing about his mother was that he had this embarrassing experience where he was showing off over the blowhole on Hood Island, one of the Galapagos Islands, and this huge wave came in and washed him all but off the edge of this giant lava cliff. If he had gone off the edge of the cliff, he would be gone because the ocean was way below this, you know, that was death. And some miracle somehow pulled him back in, up to the safety of the cliff, the base of the cliff, which wasn't a wave. It was like something else happened. And he survived, and he had a young apprentice with him. He was a guide on Galapagos. He studied nature, marine biology. Anyway, he never told anyone about it because he was so embarrassed.
But the fellow who was with him saw the miracles, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So were all the people watching, and that's why he was so, because he was the guide, and he nearly lost the young lad's life and his own life, you know. But anyway, yeah. 3 years later, he sort of felt that when he left home, he left his mother, you see. So right. 3 years later, he goes back to visit his mother who lives in Wales. And they have this lovely fireside chat. They're both drinking whiskey and she's talking to him. She said,
drink.
You know, some years ago, and she says the year and he listens and she says, I had this dream about you where you were on a cliff edge and it was dark and this great wave came and it took you to the edge, and I reached down from above, and I grabbed you by the back of the neck, and I pulled you to safety. And when I woke up, I felt very pleased. And he said he sat there with hair raising on the back of his neck
because he never
told anyone about this. And that is why he talks about mother in that way, where he says that even though you're birthed from her body, the absence is like a lost limb, while the body still feels it is present. So it's fantastic. You know, he's such a perspicacious man. He's just the most beautiful writer. I am slowly devouring this book. Sometimes I read another passage again. You know, when you need to just let it sink in and think, oh, my God, no. So it's a beautiful book. I can recommend it. Crossing the Unknown Sea. I am his agent, of course. No, I'm not. I was up in Kripalu in 97. I was working with Gabrielle Roth. I was training with her, and he was up there, and he was working with another group of people, but he gave it this most wonderful lecture. And I kept thinking, gee, I'll have to come back and work with him sometime. I don't think he does that anymore, though. He probably doesn't do that anymore. He's a wee bit too famous, you know. How are we going? Oh, we're nearly out of time.
We're going magnificently. I every time I have something to say, you keep going and I lose whatever it was I was going. No, I just love it. No, it's fabulous. We've only got six or eight minutes. You've just filled in an hour absolutely beautifully.
Yes, you see. And there you go.
you can never talk too much as far as I'm concerned, Sue. You're the easiest person to have.
Once you start on some of these memories, you don't realize how rich your life has been, and you don't realize how, in fact, you know, there's a lot of this is also sharpening in my mind after reading what he says about. He keeps drawing you back to the ancestral gifts that have been given to you in your life, and it's not, you know, we come in with nothing. Let's face it, naked. We come in naked. But the things that we end up with, and we never do it alone, is what he's saying. We have to acknowledge that all the way through, all these stepping stones and all these things that guide us or that are created by us through other things, we are so rich in that. You know, we are rich in that ancestral gifting. I guess is what you call it. Yeah.
Right. It is ancestral gifting. And it reminds me that those two stories that you've said are tied together. I have a friend who is a Tibetan Buddhist, and, but he actually, saw green Tara, dancing in the trees. I'm not sure where he was, in real life, you know, so, and green Tara is a goddess of Ireland and also, the original.
White Tara.
Yes. I do both those practices actually. Oh, I could tell you a lot about green and white Tara, but anyway, and there's yellow and there's black, and there's so many things come to mind. A friend of mine who has working on cancer was telling me the importance of melanin, and I wanted to tell them. Melanin, not melanin. Pardon?
Go on. It's a melon or melanoma.
Siberian melanoma, Siberian melanin, and it's, you know, it's the black that you need darkness for the body to excrete it, and actually in Tibetan Buddhism we use melatonin. Yeah, I meant melatonin. I'm very educated here.
That's
today.
That's from the pineal gland, which activates the seventh chakra, but it also works very strongly with the sixth chakra. With Ajna Chakra, but it's mainly in Sasarara that pineal gland.
Well, you can use black manjushri, or use black deities or black light at your throat to make your body produce it. And so, if you can't go to sleep at night, you visualize black light at your throat, and so you can actually increase the melatonin in your body just by visualizing it. Yeah. And you can also use black deities like the sort of Buddha of wisdom is a yellow Buddha with, you know,
there's
pajamas.
There's the black virgin too.
That's right. Well, this guy was actually drowning in the ocean, the same guy who saw Green Tara. I can't remember his name, and I actually had cocaine with him once.
That's why you can't remember his name,
though. Anyway, he was out in the ocean.
He saw Green Tara dancing in the trees.
I don't know. It was the first time I ever had cocaine, actually. He arrived at my house with some cocaine, with some obvious intentions. But anyway, he ended up getting stuck out in the ocean, and he thought, well, this is it. You know, I'm going to drown now. And he remembered that that before you drown, you go down about three times. You know, he'd actually sunk, and he went down for the third time, and he thought, well, this is it. I'm going to die now. And I can't remember what he did with his mind. I think he probably prayed and thought, you know, this is my death. I'll pray. And then this almighty under sort of wave came from nowhere, and it picked him up, and it just took him all the way to the shore and threw him up, spat him up onto the sand. Yeah, this massive wave just saved him. Yeah.
So then what did he do in repayment? What did he do?
I don't know.
What did he feel his purpose in life was then, to be what? I mean, it must have been, if something like that happens to you, you must feel there's a purpose there. You've got to go find it straight away, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had an experience like that. I was driving along the highway, and this truck was coming just straight at us. And the next minute, we were on the other side of it. It just miraculous. And I said, I had someone in the car with me, and I said, wow, that was lucky, you know, like, yeah, it was just coming straight at us, and then the next minute we were past it, and I only just remember that now. So, miracles do happen like that. So can you think of a song?
Can I think of a song?
Yeah, you wanted to play a song. You can
play anything by Eva Cassidy, but maybe Danny Boy or Imagine. Imagine would be nice. We've got Eva Cassidy.
Stephen, do you have either of those?
By who?
Cassidy. It's what she's English. But no, you choose something, Stephen. You've been very silent there, dear man. Hello.
You want Imagine or
Imagine. That crosses all countries.
It does. It truly does. So you and I are meeting for coffee tomorrow.
I met John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
Did you?
Oh yeah. Well, I'll tell you about it tomorrow. We're having coffee at Dalesford, yeah? 11 o'clock.
Yes, we are. 11 o'clock. We're meeting for coffee.
I'm going to admit now that I went there last Wednesday and I waited half an hour. Jill Tribble Dickhead, where is she? And then I looked in my diary and realized it was the wrong day. Oh, dear. Anyway.
Okay. I've got Imagine up there now, Jill.
Oh, thank you. Lovely.
Absolutely. Bye. Well, everyone, thank you so much for coming and staying with us on People's Internet Radio. It's always fantastic to have Sue Ingleton with us and Stephen Roberts. You're absolutely one of my dearest, sweetest internet friends, and I love you very much, and thank you for hosting this show, and what a fabulous show we had with Vin, and it's so fantastic to have you, Sue Ingleton. And Edith, I hear that you burnt your vibrator.
What did you say?
I heard you
burn it. I didn't burn it. I've been making cakes with it.
But I thought you said it backfired.
No, it went into overheat. But I realised I could use it for creaming butter and sugar. Creaming butter and sugar. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. That sounds perfect. Well, Edith, you better go on.
Probably what it does anyway. That's probably what they invented it for. I think I could design sex aids. I think I'd be good at that.
How would you do that? You can tell me.
I've got hot pegs out here. I'm going off to design a sex aid that uses a peg basket.
Well, see you tomorrow. Thanks. Good night, everyone.